are listening to the weekly podcast of Life Ministry Church. For more information, head to our website www.lmc.org.au.
Rita is the director of Amari Community Development Organisation. She's one of our own. Now, if you want to know where Amari is, for those that are new here, that's in Uganda, and you're going to hear an awful lot about the story this morning. But Marita is one of our own. She was virtually born into the church. She went to Oxley College. She was a teacher at Oxley College. She was a part of the Sunday school, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, here. Her mum and dad come here. Mum and dad were elders in our church, or dad was. And it's just been an incredible journey. And so the reason that I want to introduce you to Marita today is because, Amari is our main mission focus for this church in every way, shape, or form. Two, we need your support. And three, I want Marita's story on video so that we can use it. And also, so many people don't know about Marita. Marita, when she talks, never talks about herself, always looks at the screen like that. And we'll never tell you some of the stories that I know. So I thought the only way to share her with you was to interview her and to embarrass her a little and to highlight just what a remarkable and incredible journey she's been on. Over in Uganda, in Belusa, she's known as Madam Marita. That wouldn't be a good thing here. But, if you think of Mother Teresa, she is the Mother Teresa of Belusa. Wherever she drives, wherever she goes, kids follow her screaming out, Madam Marita! Madam Marita! Madam Marita! Far and wide she is known, and even down into Kampala, even in the halls of government, she is now known. She has screamed so much about things she doesn't like. So, Marita, welcome. And while Marita's coming, a very special welcome to Nancy and Jeanette. Nancy and Jeanette are invites of ours for today, and they come from, that's your seat there, Marita. That one, because I sit on the right-hand side. Nancy and Jeanette come from EmbroidMe, and they have supplied and helped us so much in years past with clothing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So welcome. Let's welcome Nancy and so, Marita, let's get the ground rules right, okay? First of all, if you skip over an answer in your humble ho-hum manner, then I'm going to stop you and I'm going to keep digging because I want people to know you, okay? If there's anyone out there that thinks Marita's skipped over something and hasn't shared the depth, just raise your hand. I'll see it and I'll call you down the front. We'll pray for you. Marita, that's the ground rules, okay?
Sure.
Sure. You've got to put the microphone up so people can say sure.
Sure.
Did everyone hear her? Okay, so let's start at the beginning. Tell us a little bit about your childhood, family growing up, brothers, sisters, where you grew up before you came to Wonga Park, et cetera, et cetera. A bit about your early school years before Oxley College so that people have an understanding of who you are.
Sure. grew up with my family over in Diamond Creek, Greensboro way. We went to a uniting church. Mum and Dad became involved in a charismatic church, Pentecostal church, when I was about 10 or 12. Moved across to LMC, and we've been here ever since. I've got a brother and a sister, both a couple of years younger than me, and my parents are still here, of course. Yep.
Okay, so that's good. You're doing well so far. No hands. Look, no hands. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about your life at Oxley College.
Oxley College, I started with Oxley in the very first year that it actually opened, so I was one of the original
Did
students.
You go to a school before Oxley?
Oh, yeah. started Oxley in grade six, I think I was, so came across in grade six. Mum was the prep teacher. And we started grade six, so I went right through Oxley through to year 12 and then through to university where I got a couple of qualifications. Yep.
Okay, so a little bit about uni. What did you do at uni? Why did you do the course that you did?
Okay. did the course that I did because I got the marks to get into the course, basically, and I was advised that's what I should do. I ended up doing commerce, which I didn't like at all, but it's actually been invaluable in terms of the accounting and that kind of thing over in the work that I'm doing at the moment. So I did a commerce degree, and then I actually went back after Bible College and did my Dip Ed, which led me into teaching.
Dip Ed, Bible College, into teaching. When did the vision for missions commence in your life?
I think I've always been a little bit interested in missions. My grandmother, my mother's mother was particularly, and her family were kind of involved in missions. My grandmother was always getting newsletters and that kind of thing. So when I visited her place, she would have the papers out and I'd read the newspapers. She was involved with Wycliffe Bible Translators. Mum and Dad had a lot of books around, biographies of different missionaries, so I used to read those when I was younger. My sister and brother-in-law went off to PNG for a couple of years, so they were also involved in missions as well, and then just people speaking and that kind of thing. So always had a love for overseas and overseas travel, so I think it's come out of that.
One of the times that you've shared your story with me, you shared about seeing or reading a book with a little black child in it.
I can just remember one stage. I don't know how old I was, but I had a kind of a, I don't know if it was a dream or a vision, but just had a picture of working with black children. So that's probably where it originally came from. But I've always wanted to go to Africa. Yeah.
Okay, so I remember you coming and visiting me in my office one day. You'd been naughty, and you shared your dream. You shared your desire to go to the mission field, and you were teaching at the time, and it was decided for you, with you, that you needed more training. Tell us a little bit about Wycliffe and the first stint in Uganda.
Okay, got involved with Wycliffe. My grandmother was the key for that because she was involved with them. But Wycliffe had a course where they taught people to read and write, but they used mother tongue and they used the Bible as the source text for teaching. And that really appealed to me, both the principle of what they were doing and also the teaching side of it. So I took a year off and did some training with Wycliffe Bible Translators, did their literacy course. Wasn't quite sure what I was going to do at the end and actually came back into teaching, but then a couple of families that I worked with emailed me and said, would you like to come over to Uganda to homeschool our children? And so there was a family working in Belisa doing translation, and there was a family working in Kampala doing administration. So I was actually, I think it was God really blessed me in that I was getting both the urban experience in Kampala and then alternating that with the rural experience in Belisa, teaching the two different families. And so that was my introduction to Uganda and the reason why I'm back in Belisa.
Okay, so what year was that?
That was 1999 to 2001.
Okay, so we're a long time on from there. Tell me what Kampala was like when you first arrived. Tell me then how you used to travel from Kampala to Belusa and what Belusa was like compared to Kampala.
I always remember the very first time I got off the plane in Kampala, in Uganda, Kampala. We had to travel from the airport, which is about a half-hour drive to the city. And the very first time I rode from Entebbe, the airport, to Kampala, I just remember driving along and the houses were quite decrepit looking and dusty and old, and I just kept on expecting them to get better as we got towards Kampala, and they didn't. And the other thing that really sticks out in my mind was, they don't do it now, but back in the early days, they used to have a couple of kilometres of coffins lined up along the side of the road heading in towards Kampala. And just a whole lot of little baby and children's coffins. And that's a picture that sort of stayed with me as well. They've actually moved all of those ones back now. The government's put them in different places, but it was quite a powerful image as well.
Okay, so the difference, well, you trained in Kampala, well, you're taught in Kampala, you're taught in Belusa. Let's just, before we talk about the people that you helped and show some of the photos, share the difference between Kampala living and Belusa living. In the early years, back in...
Okay, Belisa. I preferred rural to the city, but back in those days we didn't have any internet, there was no telephones, there was no communication. So I would go for a six-week period up to Belisa, which was about an eight-hour drive from Kampala, and you would have 6 weeks, apart from the family that I was teaching, would have, and the locals, it would be 6 weeks with no communication at all with the outside world, with family, with Australia, with anything. So that was quite an interesting time. I can remember looking back. I probably was doing too long a time period. I should have done 4 weeks, 4 weeks, but I was doing 6 weeks, 6 weeks. So after about 3 or 4 weeks, I began to get a bit... I usually started to then want to go back to Kampala to connect back with other people and other things. But it's different nowadays, of course, with the internet.
How do you think Mum and Dad handled you being away those first years and the 6 weeks?
I think they handled it okay. I'm not quite sure exactly. It was probably more the next stint that they were a bit...
Looking at Joyce, I don't think she did handle it very well. She didn't care.
It's hard because they would go for 6 weeks without hearing from me at all. So the family that I was with, the only form of communication they had was a satellite telephone for emergencies. Yeah.
Okay, you broke your leg over there.
I did.
And you had to travel back. Yeah. Tell us how you travelled back.
That was interesting. We didn't realise at the time the leg was broken, and so I actually ended up coming back down on public transport. And it's one of those experiences that are very clear in my memory too. I had to hobble down to the main town, and then they squashed... If you've been to... Oh, okay, they've got these taxis called... they're called taxis, but they're actually minivans. It's supposed to sit 15, but they'll sit 20 or 30 in the country. So I very clearly remember climbing onto the back of this taxi, getting along the back row where they had four or five of us instead of three, up against a wall which also had a couple of spare tyres. So I travelled down to Hoima, which is the regional centre, a couple of hours away. And then I remember getting out, and the buses are quite old and high, and I literally had to crawl on my knee to get up into the bus to then get back down to Kampala to see the doctor in Kampala. So, yeah, it was...
And your leg was broken?
Sorry?
Your
it
leg...
was broken. The ankle was broken, yes. So yeah. that was this one. Yep.
Okay, so let me just show a couple of photos up here, and you can speak into the photos, okay? You have to look behind you. You're allowed to look behind you. Oh, you can see up there. Okay, great.
That's good.
There we go. Modern technology.
Okay, so that's the Entebbe family that I was working with, the ones that were based in Kampala. So they were, yeah, that's the Entebbe family. And this is the family in Bulisa. They had little desks outside on the veranda and a little school hut that used to be their schoolroom. Yeah.
So that's the hut?
That's the hut. That's some local children. So then what would happen is after I had done my homeschooling, usually in the morning hours, in the afternoon I would take some supplies I had and go and do some work with local children. And it's quite interesting because some of those little boys in that picture are actually young adults now around Bulisa that I still see, and they still come up and say thank you for letting us use your supplies and things. Mm. Yeah.
So for those of you who have been in the church a while, you will know that part of the deal originally for helping Marita was that we would send over school supplies, pencils and paper, etc., so that Marita could actually teach these kids outside of the school compound or outside of the house compound. Amazing story, and again, just the seeds that were sown back there early in Bulisa. So you came back and you did further studies. What did you do?
I always had a passion to go back to Bulisa particularly, so I kind of always had that in the back of my mind. Did some further studies. Can't remember what I did. Did something. Did some further studies and then ended up working...
Master in Administration, School Administration.
Oh, that's right, I did my Master's, yep. Or was that after? Sometimes. Anyway, did some more study and then went and worked with another organisation that had a school in Kampala and a school in northern Uganda. So, again, I was getting both the city and the rural experience as well.
Okay, now, this is one of those ones that you tend to want to skip over because... UAF was a little bit dark for you.
Yeah.
And oftentimes Marita will skip over this because Marita's an incredibly loyal lady and doesn't want to share negativity and wouldn't share negativity. But the reason I'm going to dig her a little bit on this is because I want you all to see that sometimes God uses negative situations to train us and equip us and to strengthen us and to grow us so that we're ready for the next stage that he has. And Personally, Marita, I don't think that you would be able to do what you're doing for Amari if it hadn't been for the UAF experience and just some of the things that you saw, because it shaped your integrity, it shaped your desire to accept no bribery or to give no bribery, it shaped your desire to be pretty straight. So maybe just share a little bit about the UAF. Now, we'll show some photos and you can speak into it, but without mentioning names and without dragging down any organisations, just share the things that confronted you that really hit your right and wrong bubble, OK? But let's just look at some of these photos and start of this.
OK. First of all, it was a very, very, very good learning experience, and I got a lot of practical experience on the school side of things and the administration side of things. But I also learnt a lot about the levels of corruption and the levels of spiritual deception that were happening in a lot of circles, including circles that were supposed to be staunchly Christian circles. And so it came, because I was in a leadership position with the two schools in northern Uganda and in Kampala, came about that some involved in leadership were involved in a lot of corruption and a lot of immorality and that kind of thing that came to my attention after about a couple of years. And so then I had to make a decision, what was I going to do about it? So we tried to approach it from that side and not a lot happened. Then in the end, I just had to put it down and say, okay, God, we've told relevant people, we've told people in positions that are higher than us that this is what's going on, and we'll leave it to you, and turn around and walk away from it.
So, Kay, you came. We'll come back to that one in a minute. You came back to Australia. Yeah. Tell me how you worked your way through the pain, the disillusionment you had from that situation.
Okay, I think I was. You know, people come back and they talk about having re-entry crises and people come back and they talk about having to reintegrate into culture and the trouble that missionaries have and trouble if you've been having problems overseas. I think, in a way, God's been really good to me because I've had a very strong support from my family, from Pastor Graham, from friends and from other people. And so when these initial problems started happening overseas, I was Pastor Graham, my father, others were involved right from the beginning. As soon as I knew something was happening, I got in communication with them and said, look, this seems to be a problem. I'm going to have to investigate a little bit more, which I did. It looks like I may have to leave the organisation and leave pretty quickly if nothing can be done. And that kind of thing happened. So I don't know that I was disillusioned. I think the biggest shock for me was the level of corruption that was happening under the guise of a very spiritual facade, and just how somebody can go to church on Sunday in a good, strong Bible teaching church and sprout all the right Christian things and all of that, but on the other hand be quite immoral and quite corrupt on financial and ethics and morals and that kind of thing as well.
Okay, we'll come back and talk a little bit about that because, again, that forms the foundation of Amari and the way you operate now. Just let's speak into some of these photos. So this photo here.
Oh, this was the school in Kampala. I think this was when they were having their grand opening or something like that.
So. Okay, so you're in Kampala and then you're up north as well, is that correct?
Yes, so in northern Uganda. The photo down the bottom is from the northern Ugandan. So I was up there when there was a lot of fighting happening as well, so that was a whole other situation as well, and again quite a very enriching time, but a very very interesting time for me.
Okay, just share a couple of the stories you had of the war going on in North, and are you looking after kids and particularly the boys?
Yeah, I had okay, well, what had happened was I'd started working. There was a war in northern Uganda with Kony. I won't go into that at the moment, but a civil war was happening. A lot of students and people were being abducted and turned into child soldiers and then coming back and perpetuating atrocities on their own people because they'd been brainwashed into it. What was happening at that time, it had been quiet when I first started, but after a couple of months of being up there, it all flared up again. And I remember one day we heard a bomb sound happen, and one of the trucks had been blown up about a kilometre up the road 12 people were killed, and that was when the war started again. And at that stage, what happened was I was living up there, and I had to stay put in the compound, and I had to stay, couldn't move in or out. I was in charge of the school, and we had a lot of students and a lot of boys. And I remember one. What happened at that stage too was the because of the fighting, it was lights out at 7 o'clock. Everything had to be locked up, and so we were all in our houses at 7 o'clock. And I remember one night I got a knock on the door about 7:30, 8 o'clock, and one of the staff came to me and he said, "Oh, madame, you've got to come and do something because the boys are all wanting to run away into the bush." And what the students used to do and what people used to do was because the LRA soldiers used to come and lock people in dormitories and burn them or abduct the boys would often run away at night time and hide up in the trees or anywhere they could and then come down in the daytime and go about their normal work. And I remember my staff, some of my male staff used to go to our shipping containers and actually climb up on the top of the shipping containers and sleep up there at night time with mattresses. And so this night, this knock on my door, this one of our staff came and said, "Oh, madame, I don't know what to do because the boys are all at the doors of their dormitories and they want to run away and go into the bushes." And it was like, okay, God. It was one of those kind of things where you're thinking, what on earth are you doing up here in this situation? And what on earth am I supposed to do?
By the way, your mum and dad used to think the same.
Yeah.
What on earth are you doing up there in that situation?
So, and please understand, I wasn't in personal danger myself. I had a very strong... I was in cemented premises and I had a couple of guards outside and all of that kind of thing. So as long as I didn't travel, I was okay. But anyway, so I had to go across to the dormitory, which was about 500 metres on the other side of the road and things. And I just remember I actually got out the Bible and I read with the boys Psalm 91, where it talks about the angels encamping around and keeping you safe. And so it was good because we read that, and actually that night they went back and they went back to bed and it was all good. And then what happened a few nights later, a few weeks later, the rebels bombed a big Sudanese camp up the road. And what happened that morning was about 10,000 of these Sudanese got up, and in the morning at about 7 o'clock we just saw them all marching down the road, and it was like looking at the Exodus or something like that as well. And after that time I think I had to relocate back to Kampala, where I stayed for a few months and didn't go back up to the north. But that was some of those experiences.
Okay, so let's move on to what I'm going to call Uganda 3, which is really your present stage.
Yeah.
And again, in talking about that, I'd like to walk you through some of the things. So I remember you coming again to my office. If I get the story wrong, mine's right, yours is wrong. saying and telling us, because you were still working at the school at the time, in fact you had developed the Christian curriculum for many of the classes that we still use today, and you came down and you said, "Pastor Gray, I still have a passion for Uganda, a passion for what we want to do." And so we agreed that you should go back and that you should start a school as Oxley started, one class at a time, and that we would support you. So one of the things that stands out to me at that stage was what I call the friends of Amari. They're the people that gathered around you, caught your vision, and again, we had really, as with many things that we do, no understanding of how big and what God really wanted to do. We just knew that it was God and we were going to be obedient. And these friends of Amari put up their hand to just gather around you, to be your prayer partner, to support you. Share a little bit about the friends of Amari and just name who they were so that people are recognising just the incredible depth of the support and love that you've had.
Okay, I had... that was quite funny because when I was talking about it, they were actually, in particularly Carol and Deb, were actually more excited about it than what I was and saw more potential in it than what I did. So God obviously knew what I needed and when I needed it. But Carol, who can't be here today, unfortunately, Deb, who handles all of our administration.
Sorry, let's do the surnames. Carol Morris.
Carol Morris, yep.
Deb Hunt.
Deb Hunt, who handles all of our admin and has been with us for the last... Well, since we started, Luke Devin-Sentis was one of the initial ones. Really helped great on the technical and the support. Sue Swenser, Felicity Cutting, Dad Dad kind of got dragged into it, but he was there. And Janet Dixon, I think, was the original one as well.
So, fantastic. Yeah. Okay, so you went to Uganda. Just walk us through the journey, landing back in Uganda, going up to Bulusa. Just walk us through, step by step, the journey from when you first arrived in Bulusa for Uganda 3.
Okay. I always knew that I wanted to go back and do something in Bulusa, so that was where my heart was and where I believe God had placed the vision for me. One of the things, based on my experience at the UAF, one of the things that I really prayed was that God would put some good people around me, some people of integrity around me, because, you know, I had learned I was not that discerning in working. Now, some people say they know instantly if somebody's off or not off. I'm not like that. I can't... I just don't have that kind of discernment. So I said, okay, God, you'll need to put some people around me who know the culture but who are also people of integrity. And so I had prayed that, and a couple of people that I used to work with at the UAF who had also resigned about the same time came on board with us. And then I had the team back home here as well, of course. And so what had happened with the land, again, it was... You kind of go into it with all these visions and dreams and expectations, but not realising what you're actually letting yourself in for. Now, I didn't realise that land issues up there were incredibly tough. It's all communal land, so to actually get land was a big step. They'd also just found oil as well, so that was another huge complication. And so, again, God was really good, because when we were praying about where did we want to start, there was three different areas. And one was an area where the children had to walk a long way to and from school. One was an area where there was a high number of orphans, and one was an area where, because it was on the lake, there was a lot of cross-generational sex problems and all of those dysfunctionality sort of issues. And so we said to God, OK, we would like to work in one of these three places. Again, thinking in my mind it would be quite easy just to go in and get some land. But anyway, God was really good. We actually... one of my Ugandan board members was actually able to negotiate with a family at Kisiavi, which is where we are today, to get some land in that area. And that was actually the area that was identified as having the highest number of orphans in Bulusa district as well. So that's how we originally came to where we are.
Yeah. Okay, so tell us how you purchased the land.
Okay. we're actually still waiting for the title 10 years on. But we have...
You're not supposed to tell them that, okay?
we do have the land. What happened was we negotiated with the family, who the neighbours of our land, who we believed owned the land, paid the money. And then we found out the original 10 acres. And then we found out a few months down, well, no, you're not supposed to negotiate just with the family. You're supposed to negotiate with the community as well. So the community and the community leaders were not very happy with this and blah, blah, blah. And... but fortunately, part of our policy is that we put money into community projects that are not directly Māori, and so, like helping repair toilets at the local school and that sort of thing. And so what we... Sorry, I'm not speaking into this. What we said to the community was, we can either pay you the money that you should have had, but we will never help you on a community basis. We'll just do our own work. Or you can forgive us for making this mistake and let us continue doing what we're doing, and we'll continue to seed into the community as well. And to their credit, they actually said, OK, we'll forgive you if you keep putting into the community, and that's what's happened. So that happened with the first 10 acres. And again, God was really good, because somebody, Ian and Lynn Greenwood, actually gave us the original money for the first 10 acres as well, so that was a real blessing. Then a few years down the track, the community themselves came back to us and said, there's another, would you like to take another 30 acres? And so again, we went through the process, but this time we did it with the community, and it was quite a process, because they have to call a meeting on the radio of anybody who's had anything to do with that area of land, even if they haven't lived there for 50 years. Then they have to, you know, they have to have a village-level meeting, which involved a couple of thousand people. Then it came down to the immediate villages, which was another 200 people. Then it came down to the 15 committee members of the village council. And so we had to get approval from everybody at every single stage of the process. And we did, and we've and I think by that stage they could see that we're actually doing what we had agreed to do. A lot of people go overseas and they start working, or a lot of very dodgy people will say they're going to start an organisation, get land, and then go off and do something commercial with it, and that kind of thing. And so nobody had done what we're doing in Balisa, so people were very sceptical about what was going to happen. And so, so it took us quite a few years. But by the time we got the second lot of land, they are with us, yeah. So we're still waiting. We're now in the final... Apparently it's in the final stages of the titling. Again, because of the oil and because of the communal land issues, the president actually put a hold on it for 4 years, like no titles in Balisa for 4 years. And then because it was 4 years, then you had to go through the whole process again to submit your papers and whatever, so...
And Marita's being very gracious, because it would have happened a lot quicker if Marita was prepared to bribe a few people and slip a few dollars or shillings to a few people. But because of Marita's utmost integrity and desire never to bribe anybody, things do take a little longer than what they would normally do over there. So why a Maori gardener?
Okay. Murray Gardner is for Ken and Dorothy Gardner. I remember when I first started out in about 2009, I think it was, I was in Australia and you gave me 5 minutes on the platform just to mention this was my vision.
Gee, that long?
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So I did that, and Ken and Dorothy were in the meeting, and they came up. This is before we had any land, any sponsors, any organisation, nothing. Ken and Dorothy came up after and they said to me, oh, we believe that God's told us to give you $10,000 that somebody's just given us, and we would like you to put that towards the first school building. And so that was where our original money came from for our very first school building. And it was also the thing that carried me through the next 6 or 8 months. We had a lot of work, we had a lot of trouble trying to get the organisation established, both from the Australian side and from the Ugandan side, and a lot of problems, and it didn't look like it was happening. And so just knowing that God had already given us that $10,000 was kind of like the thing that I held on to when everything else looked like it wasn't going to be happening. So, yeah.
Hmm.
And plus they've also seeded into me as in their children's ministry as well. I grew up under them.
Great. So just so that everyone understands the structure... Maori is registered in Australia as a charitable institution and has a board, an Australian board, but it's also registered in Uganda and has a Ugandan board and is registered as a non-government organisation over there. So the structure is really clean. It's audited all the time. And again, everything we've done with the desire that we're there forever and that whatever happens in the future, Maori will still continue. And so it's been a very clear line-upon-line, step-by-step process. And I really honour Marita's faithfulness and her patience, far greater patience than what I've had, I can tell you. And I honour her immensely. Maori's size now, and it started class by class, so the first year was pre-nursery, and then you've worked your way up. You're up to year 7 now, which is boarding. How far do you go? What's the size going to be as far as children number? Remembering we're only talking one class, Marita.
Yes. We're up to P6, doing P7 this year, which is the year that the children sit their national examinations. And then our vision in the future is to take it right through to secondary, and also to help the children then go on and do further studies with tertiary. I would also like to see some kind of a vocational function on the property as well, because a lot of the... Uganda has a very, very high youth unemployment rate, so I think it's about 80 or 90%. So a lot of children, even if they go right through university, will still come back and do nothing as well, whereas if they have a vocational skill, at least they'll have a skill that they can fall back on too. So... secondary and then vocational as well.
Okay, so secondary, when you say secondary, so finishing year 10 equivalent here?
10 or 12, depending on...
10 or 12, okay. So let's do some stories from Maori. So I'm going to show some photos, and you can look at that screen not behind you so that you're looking frontwards, Marita, okay? Frontwards, up there. Okay, so just share some of the stories.
Okay, this was back in the original days, back in 2009, 2010, while we were trying to get the paperwork settled and to work on the land and all of that kind of thing. The school hadn't started, and so I was renting a house in Belisa Town, actually the house where I used to homeschool the children. And in the afternoons after school, all of these children would come around, and in the holiday time, and we called them our compound children, and they would just have porridge, and they would do some writing and drawing and colouring and that kind of thing.
Yep. Okay, next photo.
And this is some of the children. I just bought a whole lot of textbooks and pencils and things, and along they came. So they're what we called our compound children. So I guess that's where it sort of started. This is a couple of years ago out the front of our school now. So this is just after we got registered with the government as a school. Yep.
Okay, so you'll notice that there's a fence there. The first two work parties that went across actually fenced the 40 acres, which is a story amongst itself. And that was very fortuitous because since then the government has decided to put roads through everything. And if we hadn't have fenced the property, we'd have a road through the middle of our property now. Or two roads, and that would be then communal land again. So God has guided us immensely, and for the work parties that have gone, we just appreciate so much what you've done.
Yep, so this was the most recent work party last year, and so that's the school. So we've currently got about 200, or this year we'll have about 270 children in school, and we've got about 40 staff with our teachers, our builders and our support staff. So this is our staff, well, some of them, most of them, yeah.
So. Hey?
Yes.
What's that?
Oh, this is one of our nursery classes from last year, one of our lower classes. So, okay. Talking about impact, what happened was because I'd come through SIL who do mother tongue, who advocate children learning to read and write in mother tongue, which is also a known way that children learn to read and write better. We'd actually been promoting mother tongue right from the beginning and done a lot of work ourselves in developing resources in the mother tongue because Belisa and the Bugungu people didn't have resources in mother tongue. And so what happened was the government's now starting to push it to be taught in local schools. SIL and other organisations are producing materials in mother tongue. So this year they actually had a district-wide competition for mother tongue speaking and spelling and reading and all of that kind of thing. And our students topped the competition, and so they were very, very, very happy. Came away with some prizes. Teacher David, one of our teachers who's very good at, loves us and loves promoting mother tongue and also English, was leading them. So that was a good... That's where we're starting to see the fruit of what we've done in the earlier years.
One of the things that Marita doesn't say is that Marita actually wrote the curriculum for mother tongue, which I think is now being used in the local schools by the government schools.
I didn't write the curriculum because I can't do the language. But what we did was I helped... My teachers are heavily involved in it, and I just helped them on the computer side of things and producing resources and things like that, yeah. So... Okay, and that's the teachers were all very happy too that we were doing so well. So they're taking pride in the school. Again, this year's the first year that our children, our older children, have been involved in the local school's dance, drama, music competition. And they did very, very well as well. So I think we participated in 3 out of the 6 items this year because it's their first year. And so that's them all getting kitted out and happy. Yeah.
And again, as we continue through into seeing the school develop, you can see now that Marita and the school is becoming accepted in the community. And now, rather than being shunned and pushed away, is being invited in and is now showcasing a lot of what is happening. Yeah. And I think becoming a good thing for the local government and the local politicians as far as their own stories. Sorry, backwards.
Yeah, another really good story. Teacher David, who's the one on the right-hand side, has been with us. Teacher Joan in the middle. Dan, these are actually 3 of our earliest staff. But it's quite interesting. The first couple of years we started, we employed teachers, and then as soon as the government offered jobs, the teachers would quit suddenly with one day's notice to go and get government jobs, again, for job security reasons and all the rest of it. David was one of our early teachers, but he actually chose to stay with us because he liked what we were doing, in that we were helping, focusing on orphaned and vulnerable children, and that we were promoting mother tongue. And so it was quite fascinating. This year he came up to me and he kept saying, "Oh, thank you, madame, thank you for what you're doing." My brother, who's a teacher in the government school, he looks at me and he says, "Oh, you've done the good thing." Because what David's done, because he's been with us for a number of years, he's actually been able to develop his photography. He's a good photographer, so he's done a lot of photography. He's helped with the mother tongue development, so the government uses him quite a bit on that level. And because he's based with us, he's been able to save money, and he's built his mother a house, and he's also built himself a house and some farming land around, which has given him a lot of security and stuff like that. And so he keeps saying, oh, thank you for helping us, and people are seeing that working with you is making a difference. And so we're not just working with the children, we're also working with the staff and working with the local community on that kind of a level as well.
Okay, so let's talk just quickly, because we're running out of time, the medical situation.
We also have a crisis care situation and medical children's. These little twins were brought to me this year, and the father was in a really desperate situation, and somehow somebody got onto us and said the father needs help. So we went and saw the father, and he literally just handed the twins to me. And he said, "Oh, you take them because I can't look after them." Now, we're not registered to take children, and I wasn't in the position to take on two twins and all of that kind of thing. So what we were able to do was we were able to work with the father, work with the local government, work with our local church, because the father's brother was actually involved in the local church, to help the father's family to help take over the care of the children. And so what we've done is we've got some donations that helped fund a new house for the father. There he is with his children. We're continuing to support them with medical and with basic needs as well. And the local church and his brother are supporting him from a spiritual point of view. So that's been a really lovely story. Rather than taking the kids and putting them into an orphanage or taking them out of the family situation, and caring for them, we've been able to keep them in the family situation but continue to support them within that situation, which is a good way to go.
One of the things that I noticed the last time we were there last year was just at the start of the day how many people were waiting outside the compound to come in, because you were becoming known as someone who had compassion and someone who could help. And the medical needs are one of those things that people can help with. This is a photo that could be a little bit shocking to some, so if you are shocked by it, turn your eyes around. But I want you to show you, because these are the needs that come to Marita, and that Marita obviously raises funds for, and has built an incredible reputation in the community for reaching out to sick. So I'm only going to put it up real quick, and then I'm going to move on with it, okay? So this is a mum and dad with a child that was brought in January, is that correct?
Yes, so my staff just sent me this photo a couple of weeks ago. This little baby's been born with this growth out the top of his head. So he's going to need referral to Cure in Bali, which deals with all the hydro and ceph children and those kind of conditions. He's eating and drinking well, but he does have this growth that needs to be attended to. So where we live, we're 8 hours from Kampala, and the families are incredibly poor. And so they can't even afford the transport down to Kampala and other places, let alone the medical costs and accommodation in Kampala and that kind of thing. So what we do is we try and assist the families in getting the children access to medical services in Kampala, and then helping them with the costs if it's feasible.
Okay, so lastly, Jazz and Fausta.
Yes.
Just tell us about your two beautiful children.
Yes, well, Jazz is my little... I first met Jazz when he was just over 1 year old, about 1 year, 1.5 years old, and my friends in Kampala had come across him with their medical work, and he was living with a family, but they were not able to care for him, and so my friends took him to their organisation, and I met him when they first got him, and as you do, you know, I just said, oh, well, if he needs somebody to look after him, I'll have him, ha-ha. And so what happened was somebody else, another lovely lady, a Ugandan lady, took him and said that she had a dream that God had given her an orphan to care for. And so he lived with her for 6 months. But then 6 months later, my friends rang me back and said, well, you know how you said. And what happened was this other mother's got AIDS herself and wasn't in the position to raise him long term. And so they said, would you like to have a think about it? Would you like to take him on? And so that's how I got Jazz. And he's down here in the front here with me now. And he's adopted and is an Australian citizen as well. And other little girl, Fausta, came about 2 years ago. The police came to me and said, police and probation said, called me up to the police station and said, oh, there's this little girl who's... I got up to the police station not knowing what they wanted me for. It turned out there was this little girl that had been abandoned at the police station, very malnourished. They said, could I take her into care while they tried to trace the mother and the relatives? What happened was the mother did turn up and was taken in by the police, comes from Kenya or Tanzania, we're not sure where, was taken in by the police, questioned for about 2 weeks by them and us to try and find out anything we could. And then the mother, once the police released her, we kept her on the property with us for a week, and then the mother just ran off and we haven't heard from her since. So that was about a year and a half ago. So Fausta's still living with us. She's been formally fostered by myself, and I'll probably be going for adoption if I can get all the right papers this year, because the mother has abandoned and we don't know any family connections.
Okay, we're running out of time. So just tell me what your greatest need is right now.
Well, greatest need is always prayer, of course. So just prayer that God would continue to open doors that he wants opened and shut doors that he wants shut, and give us wisdom in community relations, and give us wisdom in dealing with the government and that kind of thing. So that would be the greatest one. And then our school runs on sponsorship for the children, so getting the children sponsored is another one. And then our medical always runs off donations from people, so that's another area. Mm.
Good job. Let's thank Marita for an amazing story. Stay there. Hey, Jazz, come on, sit on Mum's knee. I just want to ask you a question, Jazz. Hey, Jazz, is Mum good?
Yes.
Oh, good. This is Craig Moulton, and Craig looks after our sponsorship side of things, and, of course, he's going to tell you what we need. You have not because you ask not. By the way, we have another work party going in June, and we have two spaces to fill if anyone thinks that they'd like to come on a work party in June for 3 weeks. Craig, thank you.
There's your clicker. Thank you. Thank you, Graham, and good morning to everybody. Well, to start off, a big thank you to the church here at LMC for your support of Māori. When I look down the list, many of you are supporters, so thank you very much. At the moment, we have 231 children that we support and we actually fund in the school. And only 159 of those at the moment are fully sponsored and covered by giving. So there's a bit of a gap there. And as you've heard, Māori's property and programs have continued to develop with your gifts. So thank you so much for all that. Now, this morning, can you do a couple of things for me? I need your help this morning to make this happen. Firstly, Graham really knows that I like to use my phone during church. And I think he's told you all that a few times. So can you all do me a favour and get your phones out this morning, because I want you to do something for me. Now, on your phone, I'd like you to look up a website for me, okay? And another thing while you're doing that, get your newsletter out, and inside your newsletter, there's a little giving slip. So if you could grab those two things for me, please, that'd be great. Thanks. All right, as you can see, the website address there is on the front, amari.org.au. So if you could type that into your phone, and so we can keep Amari front and centre in our lives and something that God can speak to you about, have that in your favourites or your homepage or a bookmarket, or have it something there so you can just click on it when God's speaking to you about Amari or something drops in your heart, so you can just be keeping up to date with what's going on. Now, if I just click on... It's going the wrong way, Graham. Boom, boom, boom. Here we go. Here's the website that I picked up last night. And inside the website, you've got the full story of Amari. You've heard it all from, or a bit of it this morning from Marita, but there's a lot more information about Amari. It tells a story about many children, the areas where you need support. It has newsletters, updates, practical information about how you can be involved, and importantly, and why I'm here, is how you can donate to Amari. So today, if you're led to support Amari, the website amari.org.au is a great place to start, and it'll give you more details about how your support can make a difference. And it gives you all the details in what area your support is being used. Now, something very important about Amari, most 100% of the money that we collect in our donations goes to Amari. We don't take a big administration fees out. All there is the bank fees that come out of your credit card, but 100% of the money goes to Amari. So the areas that we need your help in today is child sponsorship. There's currently 72 children that we need child support for. These are kids that we are not funding at the moment. They're just being covered by general fees. Capital development costs, children's medical, which Marita just mentioned before, and obviously supporting Marita in her everyday expenses. So this year we have 25 new children and 47 existing children that need support. Let's go back again. So how can we fund these children? How we do it is through a $90 a month fee or support amount. And now you can pay that as $90 a month, or it can be covered in a third part or a half part. So that can be done on your credit card on a fortnightly or monthly, or you can do it on an annual amount. So I encourage you this morning to consider what sponsorship is the best for you and your family and what God is speaking to you about. Now, Amari works with an Australian organisation called Australia Hope International, or AHI, and AHI help us with the tax deductibility, so you can actually claim a tax deduction for Australian taxpayers. As we're talking about, we're always needing to develop the property there, and we have a lot of need for capital development, so we need donations towards building physical infrastructure on our property, school buildings, staff accommodation, and one-off things that happen from time to time. Marita needs to live, and we need to take care of her. She works hard, and she needs support too. So if you feel you want to support Marita, you can also do that. We also mentioned medical support, and that's Mari providing ongoing help and support for children with their medical needs. Your support will facilitate access to Kampala and other regional centres for assessment, treatment and surgery, was what Marita just said before. So how do we make this happen? Now, you've got your phone open at the moment, and you can see that there's a little button there on amari.org.au called Donate. And if you click on that, you can do it online. And if you click on the I would like to sponsor a child, you click onto that and it opens a page where you can fill in all the information that's needed to sponsor a child, and we'll be in touch with you. If you want to make a one-off donation to one of those things I was mentioning earlier, you can click on Make a Tax-Deductible Donation, and that opens up a secure website, and that will allow you to mark which area you want the funds to go to. Now, if you like it the old manual way, we've got some good paper here for you to use. So in your notice today, as I've asked you to get out, we've got a credit card payment slip, and you can fill that out with all your CVC expiry date and credit card information. Please tick on if you like a tax receipt, and we'll arrange that for you. And you also need to mark specifically where you want the funds to go to, okay? Also, over the table there, there'll be a manual child sponsorship donation form, which I'll have here, and you can come grab one of those from me if you need it also. So I'll be down at the stand down there after the service. If you've got any questions, like to talk about anything, come see me, and we appreciate your help. Thanks very much.
Let's thank Marita and Jazz for what they've done today. Bless you.